Good afternoon and welcome to this first forum of 2004. I'd like to draw your attention to three other very interesting sessions which are scheduled for this term. And there's a notice giving the times and places for each on the back. I'll just mention that on February 11th, in the Hep Theater at 4 p.m., the Harvard astronomer historian will be here speaking on the subject, Dare a Scientist Believe in Design? And then on the 2nd of March at 4 o'clock in this same room, the Dawson Library room, Professor Mark Fackler from Calvin College will deal with the topic Forbidden Knowledge, Click It or Ticket. So that has to do with Professor of Communications delving into the public communications. And then a very interesting session coming up also this term on the 23rd of March. Janet Danielson will speak on the opera that she's composed under the topic The Marvelous History of American of Nimigan and the Process of Writing Opera. But today it's really quite a special pleasure for me to introduce my longtime friend Gordon Carpenter. Gordon took a science degree at Queen's University of Kingston, and then he went on to study theology and took a degree, a Master of Divinity in Chicago at the Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And for many years now, he's been active on the campus, interacting with students and faculty, and he has proved to be, in my estimation, a wonderful catalyst encouraging us towards both intellectual and spiritual development. And many of us have again valued his insights, the breadth of his knowledge, and his insatiable concern for the deep problems of human existence. It's very fitting today that the topic that he's going to take up, because surely the problem of good and evil remains one of the most urgent problems of the 21st century. And as Gordon has told me, that Charles Taylor has written, we've written so many goods out of our official story, we have buried their power so deep they're in danger of stifling. And today Gordon's going to share with us the benefits of the deep studies he's been doing in his doctoral program on the thoughts of Foucault and also, in contrast, Charles Taylor. So, Gordon, please go ahead.
Now, I just mentioned that we need to vacate the room at 5:30, so we'll have to bring the discussion period to a close just before that time. Please go ahead, Gordon.
Thank you. I guess we're live. Well, it's my privilege to... Is it live? Yes, I think it is. It's my privilege to work with you on this very interesting figure, Charles Taylor, and his concept of the moral self. It's been challenging to read him, to study him, and to dig into his insights. But I think in the context of our contemporary society and in the wake of Enron and several other scandals in society where top people are really spending our moral capital, nothing could be more relevant than a discussion with Charles Taylor this afternoon about the moral good and the moral self. So I hope you enjoy this time together and hope we can have some good discussion afterwards. Our topic is Charles Taylor and the Retrieval of the Good in Moral Discourse. Taylor is really one of the most influential thinkers in the late 20th century and early 21st century. He's one of our top Canadian philosophers, born in Montreal, educated in his early days in McGill. He went over to Oxford to continue his studies in doctoral work, and at that time, he studied philosophy, political science, and economics, what's well known as PPE, and he was a fellow at All Souls College. So he completed his doctorate in 1961. One thing that's notable about him is that he often came in tension. This is a little bit loud, I think. Welcome. He came in tension with the philosophy establishment of Oxford at the time. The post-war group in the late 50s were very much hardcore analytical thinkers. And what Taylor really tried to do is bridge the gap between continental and analytical thinking, because he was interested in dialectical and phenomenological traditions of the continental Europe. And he, so on his own, in the midst of the analytical school of philosophy, he drew on Hegel, Husserl, Heidegger, and Merleau-Ponty, much to the chagrin of his colleagues there. So he managed that tension, but despite all this, he became what is called he took on a paradoxical role of being the leading analytical exponent of continental philosophy. And he mediated that both to England and to continental Europe as his works were translated. One of the things to note about Taylor is that he very much reacted to the professionalization of philosophy and the sense that philosophy should be isolated from politics and cultural studies and the humanities. And he was also concerned that the philosophical establishment over-professionalized the study. He was much more of an interdisciplinarian and very much explored the possibilities there. Taylor believed that philosophy should be living, accessible, and relevant to ordinary thinking people. And in this light, he himself was quite politically involved, both as a student at Oxford. He was involved in leading a Ban the Bomb campaign in the UK. And also when he came back to Canada, in the context of Quebec politics, he was very involved in the NDP party, ran for public office 2 times, failed both times, but he says he learned a lot from his involvement. And as many of us know, Charles Taylor has been quite involved in the whole discussion of multicultural societies, of which Quebec is clearly one example. He's been quite involved in speaking into the Quebec language and cultural issues as well. Taylor has written many substantial works, including his 600-page book on Hegel, his Malaise of Modernity, 2 philosophical papers, volumes. One is called Philosophy and the Human Sciences, and the other Human Agency and Language, and also Multiculturalism and Politics of Recognition. So his work is fairly broad, but we're going to focus more on the work that's developed the best in his Sources of the Self, The Making of the Modern Identity. And that'll be the focus of our discussion today. He taught at McGill University, University of Montreal, and also 3 years in Oxford. Became a full professor in 1973 at McGill. Nicholas Smith, one of his critics, says, Taylor brings theory and practice together in an unusually vivid way. He draws on his considerable philosophical learning to illuminate key contemporary issues. His understanding of theoretical matters is informed by his considerable practical experience in politics. Well, let's move on to our topic for today. It is true that Taylor is one of the key interlocutors, one of the key voices in the contemporary moral and ethical debate. He has really contributed to that in a significant way. His account of morality is tightly interwoven with his analysis of the self, so he sees those two working together. He writes, selfhood and the good, or selfhood and morality, turn out to be inextricably intertwined themes. And again, our sense of self is connected to the stand we take on issues that really matter to us. In this book, he both gives us a kind of framework of the moral self in the early section, and then studies the history of how one interprets the self and the history of how the good was taken over several centuries, particularly in the modern, the early modern to a late modern period. It's quite a phenomenal undertaking on his part, and I think really a profound work that many scholars have wrestled with over several years. Taylor believes fundamentally that he can discern certain givens, certain structural features that are common to the moral self, the moral life of all human beings. He notes changes in the concepts of good and the interpretation of the self down the centuries, but he is sensitive to what is both universal and what is plural but not relative. That's a significant point of contrast. I'll focus on the structural elements that which he considers endemic to the human condition, and they are as follows. The concept of strong evaluation or qualitative discriminations, the whole idea of moral frameworks or horizons, what he means by articulation, the bringing these moral goods into an articulate position, the idea of narrative and communal dimensions of the self and morality, the hypergood and the constitutive goods. We'll see how far we can get in this in the time we have available to us, but we'll try and at least hit the main high spots of this discussion. Taylor carefully makes distinctions between what changes and what remains the same in identity and moral life. His project is inherently a critique of what he considers the extreme of subjectivism, relativism, and projectivism in modern moral philosophy. He reacts, for instance, to what he perceives as reductive narrowness and limitations and the lack of vision of the good, even the suppression of the good in modern moral thinking. In that sense, he plays a bit of a gadfly, like Socrates did, especially with respect to naturalistic metaphysics, or those who apply too strongly the natural sciences to the human sciences or the human condition. Taylor really wants us to pay attention to the complexity of the human being and the human condition, and we'll see that as we unpack what he has to say. He believes that there are more fundamental issues that shape the way we move as moral beings in the world. So we want to begin to make a case for Taylor's moral realism. He brings critical reflection to moral philosophies of early and late modernity and argues for strongly valued goods that are both intimately related to the moral self and yet have some transcendence. That is, that they are not reducible to one's choice or attraction to these goods. He argues that the constitutive goods, the hypergoods, that ground and direct our moral beliefs and that empower our moral judgments, our choice and choices, are real and not illusory, that they transcend themselves while never being separate from the human lived moral reality. They are quote-unquote objective components of our moral universe and our moral experience. They are not reducible to either biological programming, survival instincts, or inner desires. Taylor makes extensive comment on why and how belief in the good has been lost in Western intellectual circles, especially since the 18th century. He makes the bold claim in his work that everyone, regardless of philosophical or ideological bent, is affected, motivated, and shaped by a higher good. Even those who deny this out of hand the idea and existence of such a good. Taylor's argument for moral realism is fourfold. First, he argues for the existence and ubiquity of moral intuitions and judgments as a common human experience. These intuitions transcend basic human desires for survival, sex, or self-realization, and cannot be explained without the existence of a moral realm. They stand above these desires and long to discern them. For Taylor, the human animal is a moral animal. Morality, for Taylor, is a human phenomenon. Secondly, he argues that there is an inescapable moral picture or framework, a moral orientation or map, he waxes geographical at this point, which backgrounds and offers to make sense of our moral experience and questions. Those debates, those deliberations and decisions we make day to day in our moral existence. Thirdly, he recognizes the hypergood as the key defining feature of this moral horizon and the great influence over moral deliberation. The hypergood is what he calls the reigning good within a moral framework. Fourthly, he speaks of the constitutive good or sources of the good. And this is a significant contribution on his part. The sources of the good which gives our life goods the quality of goodness. They have it gives qualitative significance to them. For Taylor, it's the articulation of these concepts that is critical to the contemporary moral philosophy. It is these strong values that are constitutive of identity, and we put life goods in jeopardy if we do not reflect on moral sources. As Phil read earlier, he says, his project is we need to uncover the buried goods through rearticulation and make them sources to empower us once again. Well, what kind of realism is Taylor offering? He seems to try to find a balance between what's called projectivism and strong realism. Projectivism is a belief which explains away morality as a meaning imposed by humans on a morally neutral world. It's a morality of mere construction. Moral goods in this case would be merely an illusion, but an illusion we all live by. As opposed to Nietzsche, who believed that there are no facts and only interpretations, realists say that there are both facts and interpretations, that there is a world that is independent of human beings' interpretation and understanding of it. Taylor refused the idea that ethics is history all the way down, that it's reducible to the construction of each culture or generation or group. Australian scholar Ruth Abbey claims that Taylor is a strong realist, but not a Neoplatonist. That is, Neoplatonism is the view that the good is part of the metaphysics of the world. It's part of the very structure of the universe, and that the rational self contemplates that particular good structure. Platonic moral realism has been discredited because it was heavily dependent on this idea of an ontic logos, or a meaningful order. Therefore, Abbey calls Taylor his type of realism a falsifiable realism, somewhere between a weak and a strong, more towards a strong version of moral realism. So, if this is projectivism, and this is Plato over here, Taylor is somewhere towards Plato, but not quite that far. I think that's significant in understanding Taylor. One of the things that's sometimes difficult to grasp when you first enter Taylor's discourse. He takes the fact of human moral experience seriously and imputes ontological significance to it. Morality is no joke, no illusion to Taylor. He considers this experience true to the moral world, which of course is always intertwined with the human world. The best account of morality must be one that incorporates the fact that individuals experience goods as being worthy of their admiration and respect for reasons that do not depend on their choice of them. So beginning with humans and human moral experience, Taylor takes us into an account of the good, a good that is prior to human evaluation, both logically and ontologically, but is very much intertwined with it. So he believes that human beings experience the goods that command their respect in a non-anthropocentric way, as not deriving solely from human will or choice, not depending only on the fact of individual affirmation of their value. The projectivist would say, it's a value because I value it. So Taylor steps back from the projectivist on that point. So what we can do together is kind of allow the case to be built in our minds as we explore the contours and the nuances, some of the nuances of Taylor's position on the moral self and the moral good. But first of all, a brief note on the plurality of goods, which is something unique to Taylor. He derives this idea of the plurality of goods from Aristotle, but takes a bit of distance from Aristotle, because he doesn't believe that this plurality of goods can be resolved into one particular good. Let me explain that. So he says that some goods are universal, others obtain within a more limited collectivity, such as a nation or a subculture or a group. Some become more prominent in a certain era of history. But in each person's life, there is always a multiplicity of goods to be recognized, acted upon, and pursued. And Taylor holds that these goods can be qualitatively different and even come in conflict with each other. This is something to really think about. That the goods, he wants to call them good, he wants to value them even though they come in conflict with one another, even though there's tension between these goods. A good example would be the tensions in the good of an academic career and the good of raising a child in today's age, busy age. So Taylor says there's no good reason, even though these goods come in conflict, to devalue them in any way. And he rejects the idea of Bentham and others like him who try to resolve or reduce all these goods to some ultimate principle, like utilitarianism or the happiness of the greatest number of people. In their plurality, they must be affirmed as valuable to be incorporated into a fully human life. So he encourages us to do that. Now, a good example of one of these circumstances today would be the good in Western culture, the good of freedom, or the good of self-expression, and how there's a tendency for that particular good to want to swallow up all the other goods and make itself the only good in an individual's life. But Taylor is very much committed to the idea that it's this plurality of goods in one's life, even though they're intention, that is important to a healthy human existence. I think that's well worth emphasizing. So he wants us to grapple with the fullness of that. I think it's a rather profound insight. Really, what he's saying here is that this is not where we can apply Occam's razor. Occam's razor is trying to find the simplest scientific explanation of any phenomenon. And he's saying that it's the opposite for ethics, that we're not served well by science in certain aspects of what he calls a robust or a full complexity of the human being. But he's also concerned about the extreme of scientism as it applies to the moral self, but also he's concerned about aestheticism, or the overemphasis on aesthetics as it's applied to ethics. Okay. So we want to proceed with Taylor's argument. The first point he makes in his argument is that moral intuitions are a common human experience, that the good is instinctual and innate. That this idea of strong evaluations or qualitative determinations are part and parcel of what it means to be human, to act morally, to think morally, to judge the moral behavior of other people. He's working from within, but in some tension with the complex moral discourse of modernity. He links his convictions to the phenomenology of reflective human moral experience. In order to be a moral philosophy to be credible, he suggests it must make contact with the experience of one's moral life. It cannot be a mere abstraction from one aspect of that experience. He begins the argument for the good or strong evaluations by claiming that all human beings have moral intuitions and all make moral judgments, including judgments about the behavior of others. Respect for human life is one of the deepest and most universally held moral instincts in the West. This includes a concern for the other, not merely for self-survival. Human beings command respect in all societies, and the West articulates this, of course, in the language of rights, human dignity, and freedoms. All societies condemn murder. When this respect is not shown to someone, it is judged negatively. There is moral opinion against murder or against abuse of individuals. And there is a strong distaste for murder, for abuse of children, and that sort of thing. One exercises a moral evaluation of the situation, appealing to some moral criteria transcendent of the situation or case, and transcendent often of one's own personal interest. It may not be your child that's being abused, but you find the abuse of children offensive and morally repulsive. He says it this way: our moral reactions have two facets. On the one side, they're almost like instincts, comparable to our love of sweet things or our aversion to nauseous substances. On the other, they seem to involve claims, implicit or explicit, about the nature and status of human beings. From the second side, a moral reaction is an assent to, an affirmation of a given ontology of the human. So he's saying that that moral instinct is a kind of indicator of a larger moral reality for human beings. Now, this is very fundamental stuff, and it might not be appealing to you, but it is something he's trying to capture the whole of Western moral philosophy and draw it back into this. So he's even talking to the people that don't believe that moral instincts point to anything real beyond the fact that someone is having moral experience. Taylor's critiques various streams of moral philosophy and modernity and claims that human nature cannot be described simplistically by any disposition, be it the maximizing of utility, happiness, or freedom, or enhancing reproductive fitness. A case in point is the instincts of morally reflective people who might deliberate about the what would be praiseworthy in someone who gives of their money or their time for another person versus someone who hoards that particular money and tries to accumulate it for themselves. So these identified moral instincts seem to be the first indicator that humans in general do have a core moral self, not wholly the product of a culture or one's self-construction alone, a self that includes the capacity to judge in a disinterested fashion one's personal limits and also the limits of one's group. This is an argument similar to that of Harry Frankfurt, who talked about two levels of desires. And he talked about a second order desire, a desire about desires. Some desires are seen as higher or more admirable than others. This is one of the things that separates humans from animals. Taylor suggests that individuals rank some of their desires or the goods they desire as qualitatively superior or more worthy than others. They have distinctions of worth that play strongly in his work. So although there are always multiple goods clamoring for our attention, they do not all appear to us in the same light. Some are recognized as inherently more worthy, more valuable, more meaningful or important than others. A good example, my desire for my family's well-being might be superior to my desire for comfort food or the lower, darker desire to steal in order to get ahead in life. There are certain qualifications to this idea of strong evaluations, but it's important to grasp that concept first before we move on. Taylor is not suggesting that each and every choice is subject to strong evaluations. It wouldn't be true of the flavor of ice cream. For instance. Secondly, individuals are not always aware of the hierarchy that is in play. It's often an intuitive thing. It has a pre-articulate nature to it. It's tacit, something we live with, and it backgrounds our moral understanding, but it's not always something that people are conscious of that is explicit. And when he talks about strong evaluations, he doesn't mean powerful as per muscle or that kind of strength, but it's a qualitative term, which has moral force, I guess you could say. Fourthly, Taylor believes that all individuals are strong evaluators, but does not believe that they all value the same thing strongly. This is how he sees the plurality of moral convictions out there, but yet doesn't go for relativism. He does, however, believe that some goods, as we have said, do feature in all moral codes and are strongly valued by all cultures. The value of human life, dignity of a person, and mutual respect. Ultimately, he's saying that the good exists and transcends the human desires for it. It's not reducible to human choice or desire. Okay. Need to move on to moral frameworks. This is stage two of his argument. Taylor pursues his discussion of the good further by arguing that one has to make sense of these moral intuitions and one's moral experience in society. This process is, he calls, to articulate or make explicit a moral framework or horizon. something which resonates with the individual self. You'll notice that coming through Taylor is a combination of knowledge and passion as it relates to morality. I think it's important to recognize that. So this idea of resonance is important to the individual. It is like capturing a picture or a worldview, you might say. Examples of such frameworks could be offered by Marxism, feminism, environmentalism. Various theisms would also offer such a moral framework. It's a kind of moral mapping of a landscape which can describe, contextualize, and guide one's moral experience and judgments. A moral framework or horizon is a series of beliefs that gives overall shape and direction to a person's values and moral outlook. Back to that geographical image. Taylor believes that all individuals have a moral framework, whether they realize it or not. It's a framework that's integral to their very undamaged human personhood. It's very important to a healthy person. And that if one, later on he says, if one steps outside of moral frameworks, one is in a situation of crisis. One might say that's true of people who experience nihilism, the loss of meaning. He suggests that people, especially mature, naturally have an urge to discover and articulate or make explicit the background picture of their moral reflection and action. To articulate or draw one's moral map is to do so with making, it has to do with making sense of one's moral life spiritually. It's part and parcel of the quest for meaning. When Taylor uses the term articulate, he speaks of the processes by which we identify, clarify, and make accessible those goods which empower us as moral agents. So we just want to say a little bit more about the qualities of articulation. I think it's important to see that his concept of horizons is very, very significant in the whole recovery of the good. He sees us moving in a moral space, so to speak. Tied to that is also the idea of narrative and the whole idea of community, that we are embedded in a community and a language community. We are discussing morality all the time. That's part of the overall context. But we'll just try to develop this idea of articulation for a minute. He says that articulation deepens our understanding of moral values and responses by showing what underpins them. It heightens the awareness of the complexity of moral life and the diverse range of goods to which modern individuals adhere. It enhances the rational valuation of goods within a framework. So it brings things into a level of objectivity where we can discuss them rationally. We can think about the goods and the strong qualifiers in our moral horizon that impact us, that challenge us, that make us think morally. And it provides a correction, Taylor says, to the self-enforced inarticulacy of much modern moral philosophy with respect to these qualitative discriminations. And as we've said earlier, he's concerned that over-scientizing ethics is a way of burying these goods. These qualitative discriminations are both vital and unavoidable for all humans in his perspective. And I quote this quote, "To think, feel, judge within such a framework is to function with a sense that some action or mode of life or mode of feeling is incomparably higher than others available to us. Higher means deeper, pure, fuller, more admirable, making an absolute claim. Higher goods command our respect, awe, admiration. They act as a standard." So in the moral framework, it's both a description of what sets a context for our moral being, but it also becomes a kind of normative framework for us as well. And it's something we cannot take lightly. It's a conviction in the human being that this is real. It's not arbitrary. And it's not easy to give up your moral framework or horizon. And that's why he says that different people virtually inhabit in their own minds different moral universes. And you might think that, you know, when you see different figures moving into the public realm, that they, by their actions, they seem to inhabit a totally different universe than you or I inhabit. They seem to justify things that you and I could not justify. Okay, I think we should proceed briskly ahead here. The whole idea of identity is also strongly connected to this idea of moral horizon. And Taylor says that what I am as a self, my identity, is essentially defined by the way things have significance for me and how I orient myself in moral space. So whether I'm well-oriented in my moral worldview or not, it doesn't discredit the value of that particular worldview. Again, he's working towards this idea of an objectivity of this moral horizon. And some people might accuse Taylor, as they have. Some critics thought him a bit of a relativist, and he responds to some of those criticisms in this book, Philosophy and Nature Pluralism. He says that the kind of realism he's speaking of is it involves ranking some schemes and ranking them in terms of their ability to cope with, allow us to know, describe, and come to understand reality. Some schemes are better or worse than others. Moral realism requires one to be able to identify certain moral changes as gains or losses, yet it can be sensitive to the complexities of life and of moral choice. This is often what is considered the ethics of authenticity. So some moral frameworks, Taylor would say, have a more authentic state of being. They're closer to reality. Now, you can understand that this is tricky language, and it's somewhat dialectical. It's got a lot of interpretation involved in it. But I think it's quite mature language and quite significant. He recognizes the plurality of these outlooks, and yet he's working towards, he says we can evaluate them. The one thing you cannot do, according to Taylor, is find a set of criteria to set up, like a scientific criteria, which would put all the moral worldviews in front of you, and then you can pick one from there. He says it's more likely that we live in a particular moral framework or moral worldview, and that we might convert or change to another. And the reasons for converting would be a process of part of our story that's partly narrative. It's partly as we mature and evaluate our life and our convictions, we might think we need something bigger, a bigger perspective. There might be some data that we or experience that we've had that doesn't fit with our other worldview, so that we need to deal with that particular problem. Anyway, it's more like the idea of a plausibility structure this moral framework has plausibility to the individual in the present time, at that point in their narrative, where they are embedded in their community, with their fellow interlocutors, moral interlocutors. So that's how he wants to contextualize this whole thing. I think I'll skip the idea of narrative and communal structure and move on to the moral play of the hypergood. I hope you don't find this too much information in one session. I'll try and summarize a bit. Within the moral framework, the hypergood reigns supreme among strongly valued goods, commanding more respect and ranking the other goods in priority. It is actually the trump card of the lesser moral goods. We often don't think in these complex ways. Taylor claims that a preeminent good works to define and give shape to the whole moral framework. Gives examples of hypergoods that which have determinative control over the ethical system, things like happiness or equal respect, the self-respect of honor, justice, divine will, self-fulfillment. All these things can be the dominant value within your moral framework, and they can order and they can elevate and demote other values and even eliminate certain values for the individual. It is both partly definitive of modern identity. Oh, he gives a couple of important examples that might resonate with you. The whole idea in the West, we have a strong vision of universal justice and benevolence of responding to an Iranian earthquake or some other disaster or helping with a disastrous political situation. He says this is partly definitive of modern identity and yet is quite demanding to meet. So the hypergood can actually be both inspiring and shaping, but also threatening to us because it demands so much of us. And I understand what he's saying in that. But nevertheless, it does work to shape us. Whether it's consciously held or unconsciously held, it shapes our goals and aspirations. And what he's encouraging us to do as moral thinkers is to examine what is the hypergood that drives us presently. Is it work? Is it, you know, pleasure or whatever? And to examine how that's really impacting our identity and shaping our world. Living within such strongly qualified horizons is constituted of human agency, and he says that stepping outside these limits would be tantamount to stepping outside what we would consider integral, undamaged human personhood. To know who I am is a species of knowing where, this is very Taylor. To know who I am is a species of knowing where I stand. My identity is defined by the commitments and identifications which provide the frame or horizon within which I try to decide from case to case what is good or valuable or what ought to be done or what I endorse or oppose. It is the horizon within which I am capable of taking a stand. It is to be oriented in moral space, a space in which questions arise about what is good or bad, what is worth doing and what is not, what has meaning and importance for you and what is trivial or secondary. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it talks about this whole idea of the hypergood. Okay, we want to move on to the constitutive good, or otherwise known as moral sources. Taylor notes, does not divorce practical reason from moral motivations. And I think that is absolutely significant. That's a very vital and profound point in Taylor. He refuses to abstract morality from the horizons of historically situated concerns. Morality is about content and cannot be reduced to method or procedure of moral reasoning. Moral outlooks operate on two levels, he says. First of all, there's the general level of life goods. Things that make life worth living, or virtues that they advocate, freedom, reason, piety, authenticity, wisdom, courage, benevolence. And secondly, there is this idea of a constitutive good which underlies these, which is foundational to these, or one might say gives them life, as both it's both fundamental and inspirational. Taylor calls this the sources of the good. It serves as a powerful and empowering source for one's moral outlook. So both the moral framework and the hypergood need this constitutive good to fuel it and keep the motivation going. This is really going back in history. He's recalling an era of Augustine with this idea. And let me explain that. The constitutive good provides the constitutive ground or worth of these life goods, the ultimate good which provides the goodness for the other goods. There is a sense in which knowing a constitutive good means loving, respecting, and admiring it. Loving the good is inextricably linked with wanting to act in accordance with it, Taylor says. So it brings knowledge, action, emotion, it brings them together. So if you want to talk about the constitutive good, it's sort of knowledge, passion, engagement. So the constitutive good is really a source of goods. And it has this generative power. It morally empowers the individual. This is why he says that writing the idea of the constitutive good out of Western thought has meant that several of these goods have been demoted or buried in our thinking such that they no longer empower us. And we might be left over with these very high standards or ideals, such as universal justice and benevolence, and yet not have the moral motivation to aspire to them, which is creating what's called a crisis of affirmation. Ruth Abbey says this about Taylor's work in this area: by underscoring the need to articulate moral sources or constitutive goods, that empower human beings because they are worthy of love and respect, Taylor is trying to restore the old idea of loving goodness to moral philosophy. The orientation or quality of the will, in this case, impacts all other major concerns. So not only is philosophy for Taylor about the love of wisdom, it's about the love of goodness and moving towards the good, leaning into the good. That's part of narrative. Narrative is not only finding a unity in the midst of the diversity of goods, but it's also leaning into the good, moving towards it. And that's why the emotions are involved in this. The big transition in the focus of this constitutive good seems to be, in the last four centuries, seems to have moved from an epoch in which people could find it plausible to see the order of the cosmos as this constitutive good, to one in which a very common view today presents us a universe which is very neutral and finds the moral sources in human capacities. So you move more towards the self-expressive, rather than seeing yourself, as Plato would have seen, in terms of the self in a good universe, and that by reflection on that good universe, on the forms of the good, I become more good, I become more noble. This is saying that the good is within the self. So there is this transition down through history, which Taylor actually records somewhat, these various turns, the romantic, the post-romantic turn, in the book The Malaise of Modernity. It's quite significant. This leads us to the whole idea of a transcendent turn, which is what I finish with, so we can have some good discussion. God is also one of these contemporary sources of the good in the West, the love of which has empowered people to do and to be good. Michael Morgan, in commenting on Taylor's work, his account in Sources of the Self, he says that it reestablishes the plausibility of divine-human relationship for moral experience. The relationship is generally occluded or covered up in our culture, and Taylor clarifies it and illuminates the possibilities once again. And Taylor's analysis, after Taylor's analysis of moral sources, scholars cannot as easily rule out religion as an important contribution to moral thinking. In fact, there's no a priori reason why God cannot figure as a constitutive good. There's a very gentlemanly way in which Taylor brings God into his discourse throughout the Sources of the Self. Never defensively, just saying this is one of the options, you know, that God can feed our idea of the hyper-good and God, you know, different ways. But it's never, within the pluralism of these goods, it's never jagged or pushing, preaching or that sort of thing. So high standards require strong sources. This is part, what I want to finish with is a kind of where Taylor finishes at the end of his book, a kind of retrospective to his project of recovery, sort of a grand reflection at the end of his tome. Taylor ends this 500-page tome of Sources of the Self with a fairly provocative thought, a retrospective on his work of recovery of the moral self. He says that following Nietzsche, do we have to choose between various kinds of spiritual lobotomy and self-inflicted wounds? He asks whether one has to choose between a form of soul destruction or self-condemnation, the disavowal of moral goods or world hatred. Does one have to either judge oneself negatively or mutilate oneself spiritually? The crux of the dilemma, called the crisis of affirmation, is whether one can affirm the world and self and at the same time affirm high moral standards. It's an absolutely critical question he leaves us with. At the center of the dilemma is the human desire for affirmation, both affirmation of self and affirmation of the world. Going back to Nietzsche again, Nietzsche felt that one had to deny or deconstruct high moral standards, moving it through a transvaluation of values, in order to affirm the self and the world. Thus he embraces the world through an aesthetic motif. He embraces both good and evil as the beautiful. And as we know, high standards can breed contempt. There are some people who say, forget about benevolence. It's costing us too much in Canada or the United States. So the logic is as follows. One must overcome traditional moral consciousness, a conscience which results in self-negation, negation of the essential will to power, that ground that is the ground of being, and therefore overcome guilt and self-loathing. But Taylor rebuts this. He says, this involves a mutilation to some of our most powerful human spiritual aspiration. It's a heavy price to pay for this liberation from morality. Taylor writes, we have read so many goods out of our official story. We have buried their power so deep beneath layers of philosophical rationale that they are in danger of stifling. Philosophically, he has attempted to uncover these buried goods through their rearticulation and thereby to make them sources that empower once again to recover the spirit of the good, of these goods. Taylor senses the moral weight of this dilemma, the horns of this dilemma, in the West, in Western thought, Western philosophy, and yet holds out hope for a resolution, even a quote-unquote miracle. He questions whether Nietzsche's radical stance is necessary. Is moral suicide absolutely necessary? And he says this, the dilemma of mutilation is our greatest spiritual challenge, but not our iron fate. There is a large element of hope. It is hope that I see implicit in Judeo-Christian theism, however terrible the record of its adherence in history, and in a central promise of divine affirmation of the human, more total than humans can ever attain unaided. This is what I take up as a transcendent turn in the last chapter of my thesis. Taylor provocatively is suggesting that there is a sphere of sublime love, truth, beauty, and goodness that both transcends and reframes the apparent ultimacy of the irrational forces of suffering, injustice, and will to power. Forces, frankly, which often cause world hatred and self-hatred or self-mutilation. One does not have to be to irrationally embrace both good and evil, benevolence and violence, in the register of the beautiful, as did Nietzsche. Taylor points to a redemptive possibility within the Christian and Jewish tradition, including evidence of those who remain morally sensitive and yet do find a place for this full affirmation, an ability to love the world and ourselves, to see it as good in spite of the wrong. This is Dostoevsky's notion of the miracle of agape love and grace, what he calls the circulation of grace, a love that empowers one to love. So it's the transcendent love that changes my ability to affirm myself in this world. This transcendent goodness entails a certain stance towards the world. Hope expresses Taylor's poetic openness to the possibility of full affirmation in the face of suffering, an openness which releases one from the horns of this dilemma through a transcendent turn. And I finish with this quote by William Greenway in commenting on this point. Taylor hopes for a participation with the divine that returns us to the world in such a way that we are able to fully embrace our deepest spiritual aspirations and fully to affirm the world, others, and ourselves without spiritual mutilation and without simply denying the reality of suffering and evil. A miraculous transformation indeed. As a thinker situated in the mainstream of Western culture, Taylor's proposal, his proposed path to resolution of the crisis of affirmation, involves appeals to God, grace, and agape, and there is no a priori reason to judge these appeals false or misleading. This transcendent turn is articulated more fully in Taylor's book, recent book, A Catholic Modernity? So what Taylor wants us to do is affirm the good, affirm the human, and affirm the human and divine sources of the good. That's a bit by way of summary of Taylor's work, and I'd be happy to interact with your questions at this time, because it's all been a bit of a rush through a complex analysis of Western culture, and also some very, I think, some very provocative and profound challenges to our moral thinking today, moral and spiritual thinking today. So.
Thank you, Gordon. We have a little time for discussion.
who'd like to lead off?
Yes. I'm not sure what you mean by forces. You mean the conflicts or tensions between the goods?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
okay, I can comment on that. Because I think this is quite profound. It's made me think much more deeply about this issue. The profundity is that in understanding that different people hold sacred a certain good, it's a fundamental basis for dialogue. What destroys dialogue is assuming that everybody else holds sacred your particular hyper-good. And what's important in dialogue is finding out what it is that drives that other person, getting inside their hyper-good, so to speak, or their moral framework, their moral worldview. This is absolutely critical to moving the discussion from base one to base two. Barry, you and I have talked about this, that this is really important for this sort of thing. The other thing that's important, I think, is that realizing this is the reality for us personally, that there are many goods that demand our attention, and that this is not a confusing place to be. This is the reality that we have in late modernity, and we have to, Taylor was saying, we have to deal with it. And I think deal with it we must. So it doesn't mean that you eliminate, like, for instance, the family issue versus the work issue. You don't destroy your family for the sake of your work. And you allow that tension to be a healthy tension to help you pay attention to your family. And your wife will often help you with that, or husband, saying, you're not paying enough attention to us. You know, the kids are going crazy. You know, you've got to spend more time with them, not just quality time, but quantity time. So I think it's very helpful to our moral thinking to examine these goods and, as he says, to bring them to the surface, to bring them to the level of our articulacy and to wrestle with them and that. And it's tremendous. You can imagine that this creates a tremendous forum for discussion and debate. It doesn't exclude anybody. It welcomes everybody to the table. So in a sense, it respects the best of plurality without settling for relativism or pluralism. It means you can hold on to your own sacred hyper-good or your own framework and live with integrity within that while listening and dialoguing with other people. Anybody else want to pick up on that? Because I think that's very significant. And it's true that Aristotle thought that they could all be resolved into one fundamental good, but Taylor takes a distance from that and says, no, that's not true. And that's one of our problems. It's the extremisms of modernity tending towards, all the way towards one particular good or another. And then often there's a reaction. You know, we overemphasize the good of science at one stage, and then the romantics swing the pendulum the other way to self-expression, and science is bunk, you know, that sort of thing. So he's challenging us, if you look at the overview of modernity, he's challenging us very much to realize the complexity of what we've inherited. Our inheritance in the West is a very complex set of goods. And I think that's quite significant. Anybody else want to pick up on that or something else? David.
Not quite on that, but okay. I guess more generally, how closely can you map Taylor's philosophy into Christian theological tradition? You've identified him in a long Western cultural tradition, and Christian faith has been a very important part of that long Western cultural tradition. Mm-hmm. For example, when you started talking about the beginning, the sense that there is a universal moral intuition of the good, the Christian would say, conscience, a God-given conscience. You know, what I'm trying to get at is, can we excavate Taylor, and know, of course, his own theist?
Yes, he is a theist, Christian theist.
How close is the mapping here between
I think that there's difficulties there, David, and George Marsden talked about that in Critique of Sources of the Self. He said, you know, when will you actually come out and tell us what a Christian position would be on, with all your parameters of the self?
Well, I recognize that might be our project, not his project.
Yeah, in a sense, he wants to speak to the broader audience within the field of philosophy, and therefore he has edited himself more severely than we might want to do, some of us might want to do. And but he comes out of the closet, so to speak, more directly on this transcendence, the importance of the transcendent goodness of God in the Catholic modernity, because it's a group of Catholic theologians that are discussing this to honor him. So, but if you just read Sources of the Self, you enter this moral, the kind of intellectual conundrum of Taylor. You know, you're just overwhelmed with what he pays attention to, and you don't feel like he's shaping Western culture enough, but he's just trying to be ever so fair to everybody, although he does have his enemies, which would be those who are strongly reductionistic, or those who overemphasize a naturalistic metaphysic, or any sort of overemphasis on a scientific view of man, that sort of thing. So, I think that's one thing I've wrestled with. That's been the torture of using Taylor to move towards the theistic turn. But he just literally alludes to it as a sort of tantalizing thought at the end of the book in the last chapter, but ever so profoundly done from within the secular world. You know, he's kind of trying to, and it allows he would say to Marsden, that's your job. Allow you to take that further. So I think it's difficult, tedious, yet it's. So it's not easy to map him in that way, but it's either easy to work from Taylor into other projects. Yes, I think so. Because it creates the environment for dialogue. Richard? Yeah, that's kind of a foundational position, isn't it? Foundationalist position. The way I've taken this in my work is to look at the relational goodness of God as an information source of the good. That within the Trinity you have this agape love operative in the communion of love, and there is a tremendous goodness in God. That goodness is revealed in the world through the Christ. And so there is the incarnation of goodness, and it makes for the possibility of goodness by example, and also by the Holy Spirit there's the empowerment. So the Holy Spirit can be an empowerment. So it's easy to work with Taylor's system, his categories, and without settling for a sort of foundationalism. But yes, he does back off the that this is a good universe as such, right? But he does believe in a good God which created the universe. So I think, yes, he's just slightly left of Plato on that. So he's a strong realist, but not as strong as Plato. I think partly because he sees it as a dialectical or phenomenological thing, that I'm in dialogue with these goods. They have that personal resonance, that with my moral framework, I am constantly in dialogue with that moral framework as a plausibility structure for my life. And that it's not strictly, I'm in a universe that's moral, and therefore I have to be a moral being. It's not quite that simplistic for Taylor. I think it's more complex. And this is really the benefits of him drawing on the continental thinking as well as the British analytical school of thought. So...
Mm-hmm.
That's why Abby says, Ruth Abby says, it's not a scientific kind of realism. It's a different kind of realism. And that may be where we need some dialogue, because you would be more attracted to the scientific realism. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Your friend and neighborhood Cassius always pipes up along the line.
Okay. Yes, yeah, you might know more about Plato than I do.
Said in Romans 1 to 3, essentially, everybody knows and nobody does. So I think that that objective morality is the background of his remarks. He's speaking both of true and false worship and also of true and false ethics.
Mm-hmm.
But he's saying essentially in that mighty argument, there's a huge amount of denial, a darkened mind, because of a fall. It's an Adamic denial. But still, essentially, when it comes to the knowledge of God and what we must do to live well in this world, everybody knows and nobody does. So it seems to me that Charles Taylor is essentially working his way back in a very modern and elaborate and sophisticated way to that old position.
Yes, that's difficult to comment on, but there is some overlap between what you say and what Taylor's, because he's informed ultimately by a Christian worldview, Catholic worldview, and would respect the leanings of the Apostle Paul. But I think he's trying to appeal to this broad pluralistic world that we're now in. He's trying to draw people into an important discussion, even if they won't accept his Christian perspective or critique, right? That's the key to Taylor, which is why Taylor would be good for a seminar, for a conference. And you bring all sorts of people in to elaborate things out of his project of the moral self. But that idea of, yeah, that there are instincts there in all of us, yes, that's in common with between Paul and...
narrowing down their definition of the human.
Mm-hmm.
Women are not human. Children are not human. Black men, Jews, Slavs,
right,
etc. These, yes, are exceptions, and I don't have no obligations therefore because they're not fully human. But once I have to admit that so and so is fully human, every human being essentially, every rational adult human being knows,
mm-hmm,
obligations follow.
Okay, other questions or comments? Bill.
Hey, I remember when he was here saying 64,000 other questions, commandment to love. Is his horizon, does he make a lot of much allowance for the fact that his horizon is historically conditioned by the Christianity?
Some of his critics, emphasize that a lot in saying, you're really pushing Christianity on us. You know, you're trying to evangelize moral philosophers. He steps back from that. He says, you can think this way. You can examine these categories as a secular person. Like, you can even be a nihilist and have some sort of hyper-good, like in Camus' The Plague, the doctor... It's courageous against the insanity of the world and does the good and heals the people. So, it's some attempt, But that a human being by themselves can be that which constitutes the good. What I call, so the solipsist would say that what I call good is good. What Weber would say is I posit the good on the naked or neutral world. There's no moral world out there. So I don't think it's necessary to read Taylor as a Christian. You can read him and benefit from him from other perspectives. Yes, I think the idea of horizon is clearly more compatible with theisms, various theisms, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But he does want to say that horizons are possible. But they may be smaller horizons. My accusation or challenge to Michel Foucault is that his horizon has shrunk down to the expressive self, the artistic, free, expressive self. And that it's not a large enough horizon. So those horizons can be quite small. You're thinking of a big horizon. Yeah. Transcendent horizon. Yeah. So... I think it's really true that there's an inheritance in modernity, in Western modernity, which comes from Christianity. There are certain values that are still carried by a secular society, even though Christianity is not the constitutive good or source of the good. God is not the source of the good in that situation. That there is this idea of benevolence, and it's confusing to a lot of Westerners why we still care about Iran. When it's costing us so much money, or why should we send our soldiers to Afghanistan when they might be killed? But there is that strength of the Christian idea of benevolence still as a value in Western culture. So, and even the rights of the individual to some extent, the dignity and the worth of an individual is a part of the Christian heritage. He probably underplays that connection for the sake of dialogue with the broader audience. Yeah, I think so. Although he's happy to engage you on that topic in a robust way as a Christian. You know what I mean? He would be happy to enter the discussion with you or somebody else who's a nihilist in a different way, you know. There was a nihilist that asked him a question at these lectures a couple of years ago. He said, well, wasn't Baudelaire right? Isn't Satan the most beautiful being? You know, so, you know, there are people out there who have different values and still are part of modernity. He's just trying to recognize this pluralism of modernity, which we're all trying to cope with. As we do politics, for instance. Barry. Yes, I think so. Yes, he's yeah. he is trying to critique yes, Western thought. That's part of what he's doing. It's both a genealogy and a critique. And I think we're going to only be able to have one more question. Yes.
Gave some examples of personal life. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk a little bit more on the cultural level. You mentioned his entire interest in Canada, the records that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's rooted in language, as you've intimated. It has the contours of community. It has a narrative structure. So there's a history to this particular culture. For instance, the French language in Quebec is a totally different kind of thing than the English language for English Quebecer. For English Quebecers, a language often just describes the world. For French Quebecers, it's part of their being. It's part of their identity. And so Taylor is very much onto that. And he says also that that any particular culture can value a certain good. Like, remember the Homeric Greece? The warrior ethic of a guy that kills the most people and pillages the most villages, that sort of thing. We wouldn't call that a value for our late modernity, politically correct society. Yes, how these things get constructed is very complex and happens over a period of time. And who gets to set this hegemonic hyper-good within a culture? Certain politicians. Today is the State of the Union address. You can be sure that George Bush will give a kind of grand scheme and hyper perspective of where the future of the United States is for us. And so politicians definitely use this kind of language to shape their own culture, shape the thinking of the culture. That's a big, that's a course. You just asked it's a whole course on cultural studies. But it's a very interesting issue. I think we'll have to close it off there because we have to rearrange the room. And we can chat personally. Thanks.
Well.
No, we want to all thank you very much, Gordon, for sharing these thoughts on this surely tremendously important human problem, and for pointing out how inevitably in the discussion we're led to think, even if we're not compelled to think, about transcendence and about where the moral sense comes from. So thank you very much for sharing all you've done with us.
Okay, thank you.